Americans are some of the loneliest people on the planet. Actually, according to a survey done about a year and a half ago, that America has never been lonelier, nor has the average American had less self-described meaningful relationships. You can talk about why that is, or how that is, or how we got to this place where we're one of the loneliest countries, not only in the world today, but the world has ever seen. But the fact of the matter is that prolonged loneliness has an almost exact same impact on your life expectancy as a regular habit of smoking. And this does not include numbers for suicide or the opioid epidemic, which clearly has links to loneliness. In a recent study done, scientific experiment, they put rats in cages where they couldn't see other rats. And they put other rats in cages with lots of other rats. So big cages with lots of rats, and then smaller cages with only one rat. In both, all the sets of cages, they put water, they put two water containers. One of them was straight water, and one of them was water laced with heroin. And so what you had is rats with water, and then water laced with heroin, and then a rat in a cage that couldn't see other rats with water and water laced with heroin. Almost every single time, the rat who was by itself, who felt no connection to other like rats, chose the water laced with heroin. And in the cage with the rats, when they were together, or as they were interacting, the water laced with heroin went untouched. And it's because there's something powerful, almost undefinable, about when these rats were together. I mean, the rats were by themselves. They had nothing to do. They felt alone. And so they basically made this destructive choice. Because there's this connection to feeling, there's this undefinable sort of like intangible correlation between feeling alone and making good choices or destructive choices. The loneliest subset in this study that was done about a year and a half ago, it broke it down into ages and asked, what's your age and how lonely are you? Do you have meaningful relationships? The loneliest subset of all the age groupings was 18 to 22-year-olds. And you probably would have guessed elderly, you know, people who their loved ones, their family, their friends have passed on, and so they're by themselves. But actually, the loneliest subset was 18 to 22-year-olds. Now, when I say that, everyone thinks what? Oh, that's because of social media. Social media in the study had no bearing on the loneliness numbers. So teenagers or 18 to 22-year-olds who use social media all the time and who rarely used it had very, very similar reaction to, are you lonely? Do you have meaningful relationships? Actually, it looks at the people who were doing the study felt like it had less to do with social media and more to do with the fact that the average American doesn't actually need other people. Like, we can get by on our own most days without actually needing to interact with someone to survive, like we have at other times in our country's history or in other countries at this time. And so what you have is, for several generations, we kind of stick to our own, we seclude ourselves, we're by ourselves, and after generation of generation of generation of not really relying on other people, every generation gets a little more secluded, a little more isolated, a little more lonely. So is it that social media is making young people lonely, or are lonely young people turning to social media? I'm not talking about social media today, I'm talking about community. But everything about our lives points to isolation. So what we do is we get into our cars in the morning and our sound-canceling cars, and we listen to music, and we block out everything else. And if we go to the gym or somewhere public, we put in our sound-canceling headphones. When we finally get home again, we get to our homes, and our homes, and our backyards, and our architecture, and our backyard architecture, it's designed for seclusion, privacy, blocking people out of our lives. We have our own life, and no one can get in, and just, no, stay out. And we're New Englanders, so we're the biggest offenders of this, right? Stay out of my life. Stay out. A friend of mine who just felt this need, felt this call in his life to lead a Bible study. And this Bible study isn't part of a church or anything, but this Bible study is specifically for men whose careers have gone well, you know, who are doing well in their careers and their life. And he started this Bible study for these men before work because he felt like these men, the fact that their careers have gone well is probably at least on some level indicative that other areas of their life like haven't. Like they've chosen the career over their, you know, their relationships and their time to themselves and their meaningful, you know, life-giving relationships in other environments and other aspects of their life. And so he started this group for these men who are, you know, whose careers are doing well. And when he started it, he spent the first like couple months just talking about community and loneliness. And he said that he had these men who were, you know, who were VPs and climbing the social and professional ladder. And as he started talking about community and loneliness, none of them had meaningful relationships that were life-giving. Because what happened? I mean, they gave themselves to their careers, or they gave themselves to their relationships. Maybe they were married, maybe they had kids, or maybe they didn't. But they gave themselves over to other people and to climbing the ladder and to serving others and to other people's needs. And they always put themselves last. And they really didn't have that many nights out of the house. And if they did go golfing or something, they had like golfing buddies, but they talked about sports and it wasn't really like these meaningful relationships. And so you had this group of men who were pillars in the community, and each and every one of them, my friend was saying, he looked around the room and every single one of these men was desperately lonely. And so you ask yourself, man, is something the matter? Like, is something broken about how we approach life and how our community and our culture approaches life and connection and relationship? Mother Teresa says this: loneliness and the feeling of being unwanted is the most terrible poverty. The thing is, it's funny that we can be in this place where many of us don't have meaningful relationships. We don't have time for relationships. We don't have relationships. We feel sort of like ostracized or quarantined or lonely. Because today, sociologists believe that today, literally today, is the day the most people have ever walked the earth. Because of the way that we're handling food and food packaging and water filtration and medical advancements, they believe that the earth is getting more and more and more populated every day. And so that literally today, as I'm speaking right now, there are more people on the planet today than there ever has been in the history of the planet. And yet we're more lonely than ever. And how is that possible? If you live in Massachusetts, you live in the third most densely populated state in the United States. In Massachusetts, we have about 871 people per square mile. Okay? That's a lot of people packed into every square mile of Massachusetts. And yet, so that is true, that there's more people than ever, and yet we're lonelier than ever. The average person can maintain somewhere between 100 and 230 relationships as far as knowing someone's name, knowing maybe their kid's name, their spouse's name. They have some sort of affinity. Maybe their kids are friends, or their kids play sports together, or they're part of the same PTA, or they go to the same coffee house or bar or something. Like there's some sort of affinity there, and you can know a name and a face and a little something about them to have a conversation. If you pass this person in the grocery store, you would stop and talk. But 100 to 230 people. Because of social media, we are better at naming names and faces and aligning those than we ever have before. Social media is like name, face, flashcards. And we're actually learning to become better at learning people's names and faces than we were at previous times in our culture. And yet, we're lonelier than ever. Which means it's not the number of our relationships, it's the nature of our relationships. It's not the quantity of our relationships, it's the quality of our relationships. If there's more people packed into less place, space, and we interact with more people and we know more people's names and there's more people around, but yet we've never been lonelier as a country, it's not the number of our relationships, but the nature of our relationships. So then what? What do we do? Where do we go from here? How do we cultivate different relationships? If you got yourself here, and here is not where you meant to be, and you can't keep doing what you've been doing because you'll just get the same result. So then how do we change things? How do we move in a different direction? How do we, if we've always cultivated this sort of relationship and we know that's broken, how do we cultivate a different level, value, nature, quality of relationship? There's an author named M. Scott Peck, and in his book, A Different Drum, he outlines four stages of authentic community. And we're going to go through those today. And we're going to talk about those, and we're going to read in Hebrews 10 that kind of reinforces what he's saying there. But these four stages are, the first one is this. The first stage is pseudo-community. Pseudo-community is where people know names and faces, there's some sort of affinity there, and you're just being polite. Pseudo-community is where I might know someone's name or someone's face or what's going on in their life, and I might have something that I can talk about them with, some sort of affinity there, some sort of shared common experience. But we don't actually get involved in people's lives. We don't actually invest in one another's life. And we're just sort of like nice, we're sort of polite, we're just sort of kind. This is a relationship that is a relationship, but it doesn't really go anywhere. The pseudo community is like when two people are first dating and they've gotten along pretty well so far. And what do they say? They say, so-and-so, they're so perfect for me. They're so wonderful. They're like a perfect fit. We've never even had an argument. And those of us who've been married for any amount of time are like, that's because you're being fake, right? This is not because you're showing yourself and you're showing your true self, and it's because you're putting your best foot forward, and your best foot is not too shabby, right? The problem is eventually that other foot comes forward, and that's when the arguments happen, right? Pseudo-community, it's where people are nice and kind and just sort of like maintain the status quo, and they're not having too many conflicts. This is when you meet someone at work, it's someone's first day, and you're like, oh, hey, yeah, I'm so-and-so, what's your name? They're like, oh, I'm Jane. Oh, Jane, I heard that you came from that place. Yeah, did you know that person? Yeah, you knew that person too? Oh, they're so great, right? Yeah, they're great. All right, well, happy first day, you know, good to see you, nice to meet you. And you walk away, and I'm like, wow, isn't Jane nice? Right? Pseudo-community. There's one touch of affinity, and there's some shared relationship, and then you go about, and the next time you see that person, what is it? Oh, have you talked to so-and-so? Yeah, me neither. All right then, you know, it's pseudo-community. You kind of touch base on your affinity, and that's about it. The next stage of community is called chaos. Aptly named chaos. Because eventually what happens in relationships is there's some sort of competing vision or desire or intention, where you enter into a relationship and you know a name and you have a point of affinity. Oh, by the way, you know what I forgot to say? Is you know where a lot of pseudo-community happens, where people have a shared experience and similar verbs and nouns and they know a lot of the same people? Yeah, church. Church. Lots of pseudo-community happens at church. And that's fine. It's not a bad thing. You know, you guys have a shared experience. All of you think that I'm not as funny as I think I am. And so you guys can, commiserate about that. And see, like that. I thought that was going to be funnier than it was. And that's just proving my point. But anyway, and so you have the pseudo-community thing. And then you go into chaos. Chaos is where people stop being fake and they start being real. Where there's a competing vision or desire for something, where you want to go this way and I want to go that way, and we can't have both of our ways. Chaos is where two people realize that they can't both have their way, and so they have to pick what happens next. Do they go forward? Do they fight for what they want? Do they go backwards? Do they go back into pseudo-community and they say, no, you have it. No, you have it. No, you have it. It's chaos. Oftentimes, people in chaos relationships never go past chaos, right? Once you hit chaos in a relationship, where you want and what I want is either you fight it out and one of you leaves the relationship, or both of you do, or you back out of it and you go back to pseudo-community and you just keep being fake and nice and kind, and so you have this long-term relationship, but it's a cycle of pseudo-community and chaos and pseudo-community and chaos and pseudo-community and chaos. The next stage is emptiness. This is where you empty yourself of fighting for your way, fighting for what you want, fighting for what you think your needs are, and you put down the dukes, you put down the fists, and you begin to fight not for what's best for you, but what is best for the person across from you. You empty yourself of your expectations of that person. You empty yourself of your expectations and what you wanted. You say, I want it this way and you want it that way, but I'm going to put you first. I'm going to empty myself of my needs and put your needs first. This is a stage that some relationships, most relationships, never make it to. This is a stage that some marriages never make it to. You know, that every relationship you have is only as healthy as the least healthy person in it. So if you're willing to go to emptiness and look at that person's needs above your own, and that person is not willing to reciprocate, but it's always my needs, my needs, my needs, and you're like, your needs, your needs. Either this thing will eventually explode, or it'll become codependent, or you'll always serve that person, which is unhealthy too. To go to this place and have it be healthy, you both have to say, I want what's best for you. And the other person says, no, I want what's best for you. And then you serve each other and you empty yourselves of your needs and your wants all the time. And the fourth stage is this. It is true community. It is where you have people and they're giving of themselves and they're giving their wants and their desires. I want what is best for you and you want what is best for me and we both want what is best for him or her and we are serving each other, we are looking out for each other, we are loving each other, and this is how the Bible describes and looks at true community. True community happens in small pockets in our culture, but it very rarely happens in big groups of people. Because what happens is people eventually fight for their thing, for their wants, for their desires, for their intentions. And when that happens, it goes back to chaos. The Bible in Hebrews chapter 10 gives us a picture of true community. And we're going to put several verses on the screen. And what I want you to see is how many plurals there are. You know, chances are you can't read this because I really wanted you to be able to just step back from it and see like the yellow print. And by the way, our screen guy in the back who runs this made him twitchy. He was like, I don't want to do this. It's too small. I was like, just trust me. They're not going to be able to read it. I know. But you look at Hebrews 10, 19 through 22, and it says this. It says, and so, dear brothers and sisters, we can boldly enter heaven's most holy place because of the blood of Jesus. By his death, Jesus opened a new and life-giving way through the curtain into the most holy place. And since we have a great high priest who rules over God's house, let us go right into the presence of God with sincere hearts, fully trusting him. For our guilty consciences have been sprinkled with Christ's blood to make us clean, and our bodies have been washed with pure water. It's this beautiful picture of a community of people who are defined by one thing. It's not like their kid, they were serving the same PTA or their kids play the same sport. It's this one thing, this source of life and hope and meaning that they share. And because it's the defining thing that they all share, it trumps every other thing that could divide them. And it says, let us boldly enter into the presence of God together as one. And it's this target on the wall. It's this picture of this collective relationship with God. And he defines you and you and you and you and you and me. And because that's the thing that defines us above anything else, we can experience that level of community together. So it puts this beautiful target on the wall of what community should be in Hebrews 10, 19 through 22. And it's this intimacy with God, but it's this shared intimacy with God. And then he goes on, he keeps reading, and we keep reading in Hebrews chapter 10. We'll pick up in verse 23. It says this, let us hold tightly without wavering to the hope we affirm, for God can be trusted to keep his promise. This word, hold tightly, is this word, it's this Hebrew word called kateho. It's hold tightly, it's kateho. And it means to hold back, not let go, to prevent from escaping. I need a volunteer. Sorry, Jeff. I always pick on you, Jeff. But you're in the front row, so come here a second, would you? Jeff, he's going to learn and not sit in the front row all the time. Yeah, he's going to sit in the library. So here, face this way. All right, I'm going to hold on to you, and you try and escape. This will be easy for you. You're not, yes, I want to escape right now. No, I'm not going to let you fall. You try and escape. I'm going to hold on to you. Okay, go. All right, don't fall. All right, thank you. That is, let's give him a hand. That is kateho. That is to hold back, not let go, to prevent from escaping. And so let's look at what the verse says again. Let's read this verse again so we can see it in context. 23, it says, let us kateho, hold tightly without wavering. Like, and I held him, I kateho him for like 2 seconds. But without wavering means you hold on and you hold on and you hold on and you keep it from escaping. Now, what are we keeping from escaping? The hope we affirm. For God can be trusted to keep his promise. So what he does in verse 19 through 22 is he puts this beautiful target on the wall. If we define ourselves by what Jesus did for us above anything else, above our background, our culture, our political, whatever, like if we hold on to that and that first and foremost and basically only, then there's nothing that can divide us. But there'll be times and moments when we want to feel like we should be divided. And so what do? In that moment, we kateho to that thing that binds us together. And when people who should have that target on the wall, should be living that way, should live with unity and community and meaningful relationships, when they are divided, it's because they held on to the thing that was dividing them more strongly than they were holding on to the thing that unites them. Have you felt division? Have you felt people who should be getting along, who should love one another, who should serve one another, but they don't? That's because they were holding on to something secondary when they should have kateho on to the hope that we all affirm together. That's how division happens. That's chaos, by the way. We talked about pseudo-community, chaos, emptiness, true community. That level, that sort of like, I'm gonna hold on to hope when I could hold on to other things. What you're doing there is saying, in these moments of chaos, when I feel like you wanna go this way and I wanna go this way and we have a competing vision and desire, I'm gonna hold on to hope and you hold on to hope, and that way we'll hold on to each other. That's how you respond to the chaos. Keep reading verse 24. Let us think of ways to motivate one another to acts of love and good works. All right, so this is a couple words in this one we're going to look at. The first one is let us think about, which is katanoeo. So think of ways, katanoeo. This is to consider attentively and affix one's eyes and mind upon. So I'm gonna katanoeo Charlie up here for a second. You ready? All right, so that is to consider, to attentively affix one's eyes and mind to. Eye contact, look at them and be like, all right, I'm going to katanoeo. I'm going to look at you and I'm going to affix my eyes and mind upon you, and I'm going to think about you. We live in a world that's fighting, that's screaming for attention, for someone to look at us, to see us, to acknowledge us. People put things on social media, their opinions that no one cares about anyway, and it starts arguments, and it's because people desperately want someone to katanoeo, to notice me, to see me, to actually see me for who I am. He says, think of ways. Affix your mind and heart to someone. Doesn't matter who, someone, anyone. We'll keep reading. Let us think of ways. Let us affix our eyes and our mind attentively to someone. To motivate one another to acts of love and good works. By the way, it doesn't say love or good works. Love and good works. Because love without good works, it's warm fuzzies. And good works without love, it's like manipulation. It's trying to present yourself as something that you're not. It has to be love and good works. But the word motivate there is this Greek word paroxysmo, which sounds like a medical term, a paroxysm. A paroxysm is what happens when there's something that goes on in your physical body that it impacts you, you don't see it coming, you don't know what brings it on, but every so often it happens. Like someone who gets seizures, sometimes they're paroxysms. They happen so often and you don't know what causes them, but they come upon them and they don't see it coming, but they're like, it happens. It's a paroxysm. Well, this is paroxysmo. So let's look at someone, consider them, how to paroxysmo, which is to motivate, to stir one another up towards medical, to stir one another up. It's a medical term, which means to incite, exasperate, promote, or provoke. This is against someone's will. So if you're going to, you attentively attach your eyes to someone to motivate them, this is like a cattle prod. This is not someone who's like, yes, I would like you to motivate me. This is someone who's like, stop it. Stop motivating me to acts of love and good works. Like, and I just want to sit here. I want to come to church and I want to sit and do nothing and I want to leave and I want to come back next week and sit and do nothing and leave. And someone comes up and goes, no, get involved, volunteer, begin to give, begin to do life, motivate against their will. And finally they're like, fine, I'll just do it if you leave me alone. Then you've done what the Bible calls you to. You are a paroxysm. You happen to people against their will. So what he says is, look at someone. Affix your eyes and mind to someone and prompt them against their will to acts of love and good works. It's crazy. He's like, they won't want to, but keep going. They're going to be like, leave me alone. Keep prodding them. They're like, fine, I get it. I'll volunteer. I'll serve. I'll hold babies. I'll start giving, whatever. You've done your job. Attentively, affix your eyes and mind to people. And if they're not active, if they're not living the life that God has called them to, if they're not spending themselves for the kingdom, then bother them and pester them until they do. What are you doing, though, in that moment? It'll feel awkward. It'll feel weird. But you're looking at their needs, not your own. You're looking at someone whose life, they're not using it and spending it well. And you're saying, I can't abide by you not living your life well. I'm going to bother you and pester you until you do. What are you doing? You're emptying yourself of your needs and looking solely at theirs. This is this third stage of community. And we'll keep reading. Verse 25. And let us not neglect our meeting together as some people do, but encourage one another, especially now that the day of his return is drawing near. And you're like, man, like, why would people neglect the assembling of ourselves together? Like, why would, if you're living in this authentic community, then why, if you've been like promoting each other and pestering each other and motivating each other to go and live the life that God has called them to, why would you avoid that? It's because it's easier to just fight for your own needs to not always fight for other people's. It's easier to sit back and say, this is not what I want. This is not what I need. When I go there, I constantly do things that are meaningful, and I don't want a meaningful life. I want a boring life. He says, don't neglect the assembling of yourselves together. Now that you've experienced an authentic community, don't back out slowly. You know, this is what happens when there's someone and they see you for who you are and you're used to fighting for attention. There's someone who looks at you and invests in you and motivates you. Sometimes you just kind of want to be like, I can't handle that right now. I really appreciate it, but I'm going to back out of the room slowly. Don't follow. I'm out. Thank you. Thanks again. Thank you so much. I'm out. Bye. Again. Thank you. Bye. Right? I'm out of here. I can't do this anymore. Like, it's not what I'm used to. I'm used to people who, like, keep their head down and the noise-canceling headphones on, and I do my thing and you do your thing. And how is that working for you? How is that working for you? Chances are it's not. So let me read these verses again. I'm just going to read through them again one more time. And I took my thing out. Let us hold tightly without wavering to the hope we affirm, for God can be trusted to keep his promise. Let us think of ways to motivate one another to acts of love and good works. And let us not neglect our meeting together as some people do, but encourage one another, especially now that the day of his return is drawing near. And this is what we want. This is what we want for this community of people. We want to be a church full of people who know each other, who are known, who feel needed, who come in, and they are paroxysmo. They're prodded and motivated to spend their lives in meaningful ways, to have their life echo for eternity, to spend themselves in ways that God has called them and designed them to. We are not called to be a community of people who come in, who sit, sing some songs, listen to a sermon, and leave and come back and do it again a week later. Like, we are called to more than that. And so this is what the next couple weeks are going to be about. It's going to be about community. It's going to be about getting past the life that is the American way to a life that is the life God designed for us. We're hopefully starting lots of new small groups, and we invite you to be part of that. This is not because we want to have small groups and it looks good on a pamphlet, because we believe this is meaningful in people's lives. And we believe that because it's been meaningful. I believe that because it's been meaningful in my life. I was part of a small group that met together for like 5 years. It was the same people, and we were deeply known, and we knew each other, and we looked out for each other's well-being, like in every way, relationally and emotionally and spiritually. You know, we would eat together all the time. We would pray together. We would read our Bibles together some of the time, and we just did life together. In the years that this small group that I was part of was functioning and moving forward together, we birthed or adopted 6 children. 3 and 3, actually, between all the families involved. 3 birthed and 3 adopted. We lost siblings. We lost parents. We lost jobs. We got promotions. We got new jobs. You know, we moved. We helped each other move. Every area of life that can throw people off, the group, different members of the group experienced it. Planned pregnancy, unexpected pregnancy. But it was this deep knowing and being known. It's this paroxysm. It's this paroxysmo. It's this motivating one another to acts of love and good work, whether you wanted me to or not. It was us boldly entering into the presence of God together. So this week, I have a couple action items for you, a couple things that I want you to do this week. The first one is look at your life, look at your relationships. Not the number of your relationships, but the nature of your relationships. Not the quantity of your relationships, but the quality of your relationships. Are your relationships, are they relationships with people who attentively affix their eyes to you and motivate you to acts of love and good works? Or are they affinity, similar school systems, kids play the same sports? Are they calling you to be who God designed you to be, or are they just convenient? You know, we're going to ask people to join small groups for the next 3 weeks. We're going to ask people to consider leading small groups and hosting small groups for the next 3 weeks. Maybe you've been someone who's been part of a small group, and you've seen what it can mean and do in people's life, and you've just kind of been sitting in a small group for a long time. Maybe today is the day that you want to step out and invite other people into the life you've been experiencing. Maybe you've never been part of something like that and it feels super weird and super awkward. We're going to have a 6-week season. In 3 weeks, we're going to go through it. I start a new series. We're going to be in this series for 3 weeks, and then after that, we're going to start a new series. And in that new series, we're going to have 6 weeks. It's like a trial run for small groups. If it's weird, if it's kind of awkward, you can do it for 6 weeks, all right? If you're not sure if you could be a good host, you could host for 6 weeks. You could just give it a try and see how it goes. Just pray and ask God, what do you have for my life? I mean, am I in pseudo community, or am I doing this thing called life authentically and well? If you say, I felt motivated to either join a group or host a group or lead a group, then you can contact Amy at amy@harboroofhope.org this week, and she'll help you take those steps. But we're going to be in this conversation for the next 2 weeks after this week, and it's this better together thing. And invite you to look at your life this week to pray and ask God, are my relationships ones that are good and healthy and they're motivating me to acts of love and good works, or are they merely for convenience? It's not the number of your relationships, but the nature of your relationships. Not the quantity of your relationships, but the quality of your relationships. We invite you today to take steps into a more meaningful relationship with each other. Let me pray. God, I want to thank you for this. And I want to thank you for the way that I have experienced small groups. It's been a meaningful thing for me. And I wouldn't be the man that I am if I hadn't had those people around me to walk us through having children and adopting children and losing jobs and having new jobs and losing my brother. And like, these are people who walk through the meaningful times of life and who motivated us to keep going and to keep loving and to keep leading. And God, this is not just another sermon series, but something that I desperately want for each and every person who calls Harbor home. I don't want people to come and sit and leave and not experience more. And so, God, don't let people go about their life. I'm preaching to people's Mondays today, God. So let you sort of find your way into their Mondays. If people are walking and they kind of feel like their relationships, they're nice and they're polite and they're convenient, but they're not meaningful. They're not calling them to something new and exciting and fresh. And God, I ask you to have them email Amy, and we'll work through that together as a community. God, we love you and we thank you. And we believe this is your calling on all of our lives, which is why we're doing it. So in your name we pray. Amen.